Do you ever wonder what's in the water? I'm not talking about drinking water, which is generally regulated by cities. I'm talking about what's flowing through the streets and streams, especially now as the rains are returning. What's in there? On this episode of Watershed Moments, we're going to talk about one thing that we recently realized is getting into our streams by way of our roads, and that's capable of causing a lot of damage to aquatic organisms, especially coho salmon. I talked with the NCWA's research partner, Dr. Ed Kaloje, about this newly discovered chemical that's causing quite the stir.
Hey, Ed. Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, Kelly, and thanks for the opportunity to chat today. Yeah, my name is Ed Kaloje. I'm a professor at the University of Washington, Tacoma, in the Division of Environmental Science, and the University of Washington, Seattle, in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. I work in a lab called the Center for Urban Waters in Tacoma, and we work on chemicals in water that are harmful to aquatic organisms, especially fish.
Like lots of folks, Ed grew up fishing with his elders, giving him that super crucial early connection with bodies of water and the life that they support.
What kind of fish would you catch in New Hampshire mostly?
Oh, well, we had a little camp on a lake, and we would catch landlocked Atlantic salmon. And so, yeah, they're just a smaller version of Atlantic salmon that got trapped in lakes when the, you know, glaciers receded and kind of the sea level fell and things like that. And
Those versions of Atlantic salmon, are they farmed as well, or are they kind of still persisting wild in the lakes?
They persist wild in like Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine and southern Canada, kind of in that area.
Wow.
Folks on the West Coast probably know about kokanee, which are landlocked sockeye salmon. Both species of fish actually share a scientific name, Oncorhynchus nerca. There are other species of fish that are distinguishable only by their environs as well, like rainbow trout and steelhead, both of which are Oncorhynchus micus. Plants do this sometimes too. Shore pine and lodgepole pine are both Pinus contorta. They literally change shape depending on where they grow. Fish, plants, people, everybody. We're all shaped by our genes and our environments. Atlantic salmon, both sea-run and landlocked, are known scientifically as Salmo salar, and salar means leaper. These things can jump up to 12 feet. There are precious few wild Atlantic salmon of both varieties left today. Hatcheries on the East Coast began breeding them as early as 1864, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Several populations of Atlantic salmon are listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act, largely due to overfishing and the damming of rivers. These dynamic, sensitive aquatic creatures are great teachers for how to be more cooperative parts of nature as humans. They show us how to treat our waters with care.
Really heartening to hear there's some Atlantic salmon that are persisting wild in pockets out there.
Yeah, their DNA still exists, for sure.
I love that. So we'll shift gears back over to some of your more relevant work, to the work that the North Coast Watershed Association is lucky enough to have you as a research partner for, and that's looking at roadway runoff, and particularly this nasty little chemical called 6-PPD quinone. If you wouldn't mind giving the quick story of how Seattle started realizing this was potentially a problem.
Yeah. I like to start this story in the 1990s. Seattle spent millions of dollars on urban creek restorations. They were trying to fix the degraded habitat that, you know, we kind of haven't taken care of our creeks in, you know, busy areas where a lot of people live for the last century or so. And Seattle was trying to reverse that and build some salmon habitat and put in some wetlands and, you know, restore ecological function to creeks that were near people. And one of their success criteria was having salmon come back and use like the spawning gravel and the spawning habitat that they had made. And basically the salmon came back, and then the monitoring staff out in the field, people like Catherine Lynch and Steve Dam and Jay Davis, they saw these coho salmon come back and it would rain and they'd find those exact same coho salmon dead downstream the next day. And that really got people noticing and observing that there was a problem with coho salmon and stormwater. Like something in that stormwater was killing those fish when it rained. I came to UW in 2014 and I was lucky enough to join this amazing team working on this problem. And we pretty much just tried to see what chemicals were present when coho salmon died. And that kind of kicked off our, you know, this whole set of work that got us to tires. Yeah, it kind of started a journey toward.
Yeah, and so you started with how many thousands of chemicals before you distilled it down to this one?
Yeah. So some of our initial studies, we just saw a bunch of tire rubber chemicals in water that came from samples where coho salmon had died. And that really got our lab focused and thinking a lot about tire rubber chemicals as a source of pollution to watersheds. Meanwhile, Jen was looking at other vehicle fluids and things like that, you know, vehicle chemicals. And
Jen is Jennifer McIntyre at the University of Washington, Puyallup.
None of them killed coho, but tire leachate did. Like if you just scrape away some of the rubber on the surface of your tire and you soak that in water, coho cannot exist with that. And so when we soak little bits of tire in water, we see 2,000 to 3,000 different chemicals appear in the water after the tires contacted the water. And
wow. Yes. And how many of those do we like are like listed somewhere and identified?
We don't have any idea what chemicals are used in tires. Like, I've been asking for years, we really should get an ingredient list. And the reason for that is that, you know, tires are everywhere. Roads are everywhere. Our vehicles are everywhere. And tires are made to wear away. Like, they wear away as we use them. So we're discharging, like, thousands and thousands of pounds. You know, millions of pounds of these tires are ending up in the environment every year.
Yeah, I've read that the average American produces 10 pounds of tire particles a year.
I've seen it anywhere from 4 to 10 pounds a year. And if we don't know what's in them, we actually can't tell if they're safe for fish, for aquatic organisms, even for people. And so this is a real issue that needs attention. And we should be caring about the chemical ingredients that are used in tires because there are some not friendly chemicals in those products.
Totally. And ironically, you know, though this is a tire-derived chemical, this is not... this would not be on the ingredient list. So 6 PPD is on that ingredient list, but 6 PPD quinone is a transformation product from interacting with ozone. And so that's like, that's the scary thing. We have so many studies that look at particular chemicals that are added to things, but they're just in a big old chemical soup party where they're banging into each other and breaking apart and combining with new things. And it's a interesting, beautiful, scary situation.
Yeah. So let me describe what 6 BPD and 6 BPD quinone are. In 2017, Jen McIntyre's lab figured out that something was toxic in tire leachate. So we started to manipulate that tire leachate to kind of take chemicals out and kind of see where the toxicity went. And eventually we figured out it was this compound called 6 BPD quinone or 6 BPDQ. That was something that was in tire leachate that was super, super toxic to coho. And when we kind of investigated like where this chemical came from, we figured out that this compound called 6 BPD, which is an antiozonant or preservative for tires, was the source of the 6 BPD quinone. So pretty much ozone damages tires. The tire industry uses a chemical called 6 BPD to protect those tires, to keep them strong and durable and last 50,000 miles.
Versus
1,000 or
two.
Yeah, so it's a huge difference. It's a super important chemical. You know, tires need antiozonants. They need anti-degradants.
And you're saying people used to wax them back in the 30s.
Yeah, before they had 6 BPD, tires were waxed. They had a physical wax layer on the surface of the tire to prevent the ozone from contacting the rubber because the ozone would break down the rubber. Mm-hmm. So when 6 BPD does its job, when it reacts with ozone, it creates a more toxic, more persistent compound called 6-PPD, quinone. And we believe that is the primary causal toxicant for these coho mortality events. Like 6-PPD quinone might be the most toxic chemical yet discovered for fish. We have not found a chemical in the scientific literature, to the best of our knowledge, that's more toxic to fish than 6-PPD quinone is for salmon.
So when testing the toxicity of something, scientists do experiments to determine its lethal concentration, often notated in literature as LC50. This number tells you an amount of a chemical that kills half of the animals of a given species exposed to it. So say you have a tank with 500 liters of water in it, and you add 500 nanograms of substance X. That's 1 nanogram per liter of water, 500, 500. And if there were 10 coho in that tank and 5 of them die after that exposure, then your LC50 for substance X equals 1 nanogram per liter for coho. How much is a nanogram, you ask? Well, a nanogram is equivalent to 1 part per trillion with a T. So for perspective, a trillion seconds? How many years do you think that is? It's about 31,688 years. The actual LC50 for coho salmon of 6-PPD quinone is between 40 and 100 nanograms per liter, which basically means that any detectable amount is too much. However, strangely, this is not the case for all species of salmonids.
It's toxic at extremely low levels to coho salmon specifically, followed by like lake trout and brook trout, and then a little bit after that, rainbow trout, which are also salmon. You know, they're Onchohynchus too. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting and actually surprising finding that 6-PPD quinone is really toxic to some salmon, but not other ones. Like coho cannot coexist with tire rubber, but chum salmon, and we think sockeye and pink salmon and probably Chinook, don't seem to be affected by the 6-PPD quinone the same way coho are. So they're not having these same symptoms and issues. But it also tells us we need to really understand like why some salmon are sensitive to chemicals and other ones aren't. Like nobody really knows that yet. And until we kind of get a handle on that, we're going to struggle to understand what chemicals are toxic and which ones are safe. And so that's also, I think, work that's going to come out of this project. So we just better understand where chemical toxicity comes from.
I like Ed's phrasing there. Where does toxicity come from? What makes something toxic? For example, we know that cyanide blocks the electron transport chain in mitochondria and prevents cells from using oxygen, which can kill you pretty quickly when your cells don't make that ATP. Shout out to high school biology. But scientists don't yet understand what is going on inside of coho, or any other creature for that matter, humans included, when they're exposed to 6-PPD quinone. Lots of sublethal effects are starting to be documented in everything from nematodes to humans, including neurobehavioral changes, reproductive dysfunction, and digestive damage, which researchers think might be due to stressing out our cells' little batteries, aka mitochondria, or disrupting the way creatures break down fats, or even through DNA adduct formation, which is when your DNA changes because a reactive chemical binds to it. And these reactive chemicals are often carcinogens. And car tires are everywhere. Rubber is everywhere, even on the soles of your shoes. And as far as we know, it's all got 6-PPD in it. You can be exposed to 6-PPD quinone by breathing or drinking in particulates in the environment, or even through skin contact. Not only is it everywhere, but it also seems to last a long time. 6-PPD quinone, compared to its parent chemical 6-PPD, is much more persistent. Is that right?
Yeah, so 6-PPD was long thought to be, it's actually a toxic chemical itself. Like 6-PPD is not a safe chemical. Its safety data sheet, which is required to be produced at, you know, for every chemical that's used in commerce.
Right.
Says that it has, I think, either very high toxicity or extremely high toxicity to aquatic organisms. But it kind of reacts in water really quickly. So people kind of thought 6-BPD was toxic, but it kind of disappeared fast enough we didn't have to worry too much about it. But the problem is when it reacts with ozone, it makes 6-BPD quinone, which instead of lasting for like 2 or 4 or 6 hours, it lasts for weeks and months and is more toxic. So that it's a good example of how, you know, when a chemical disappears in the environment, it doesn't just disappear to nothing. It's still, some form of it is still floating around the environment that is sometimes harmful to organisms. You know, when you use a tire on the road, little bits of your tire are worn away. And so that's called a tire wear particle. It's basically a microplastic. Like, tires are actually the biggest source of microplastics to freshwater and I think marine environments. So there's no other source of microplastics that's exceeding the amount of tire wear we're leaving on our roads.
So it's rubber and bits of plastic.
People think of microplastics as like broken up plastic bottles or fishing net debris or, you know, little bits of your synthetic jacket. And that's all true, but actually tires create a microplastic too. Like rubber is actually a polymer just like a plastic is. And so, yeah, I mean, if you look, tires are a huge source of the same type of microplastic particle. You know, I think tires are increasingly recognized as just potentially the biggest, and I don't even think potentially, I think they're considered to be the biggest source of microplastics to fresh waters and marine waters. And so it's just even more important to know what's in them, because at least, you know, Kelly, I think you mentioned a study in China where, you know, they detected 6-BPD and 6-BPD quinone in deep ocean sediments, probably because these little tiny tire particles either moved through the air or went down the river and kind of deposited 50 miles off the coast in the sediment, and they continually discharge low amounts of these tire chemicals into the sediment, you know, for, I don't know, probably years.
Yes.
And so that's probably where those detections come from.
So it's coming off of your tires. It's coming off of the tiny pieces of your tires that break off and float around in the air and the water and continuing to release these chemicals. And we know that 6-PPDQ is persisting for a fairly long time in water. Its half-life, or the time it takes for half of it to turn into something else, is around 2 weeks in river water, possibly months in soils. But there's still so much that we don't know about this toxin.
There's a bunch of data gaps that need to be filled to better manage this chemical and tire rubber pollution in general. And luckily, you know, there's a bunch of states and research groups and, you know, nonprofits and people all around the world actually putting time and effort to figuring out this system, seeing how long these chemicals last, seeing what treatment systems work well, what kind of policy or, you know, product options we have to fix this, and kind of how we move toward safe tires that are made with non-toxic chemicals and safe roadway runoff that doesn't kill fish, because that's kind of where we need to get.
Yeah. And last night at Nature Matters, you mentioned some of the litigation that's sort of holding tire production companies to answer to for this and to potentially find alternatives.
Yeah, so the tire industry is very aware of this set of data that says 6-BPD and 6-BPD quinone have this like really high toxicity to coho salmon and other fish. I know they're working on alternatives. I know they're putting effort into like figuring out how we could replace 6-BPD in tires. Exactly when that's going to happen and, you know, what compound replaces 6-BPD and how safe it is, or even what safe means.
Yeah.
Like, you know, do we have a non-toxic tire or a slightly safer tire, right? That could be a big difference.
Yeah.
They're paying attention. Things are happening. You know, in the U.S., lawyers have now gotten involved. Yeah, so there's just a lot of things happening in the legal lawsuit space.
Mm-hmm.
So probably at the end of the day, a judgment or a judge will have an opinion on how quickly a replacement should happen, or, you know, what should happen with 6-BPD in our tires and kind of how that process proceeds. So we'll see. We'll see how close we get to a salmon safe tire that's made with non-toxic ingredients. Because if we're going to fix roadway runoff, at the end of the day, we need to make sure all the chemicals used in tires do not harm people, do not harm salmon, do not harm fish.
Yeah.
That's where we need to get.
That would be ideal. And still TBD on 6-PPD quinone's effects on people, but there have been studies that have shown it present even, oh my gosh, you mentioned in spinal fluid.
Yeah, I think 6-PPD and 6-PPD quinone have been documented in most of the human urine samples that one study in China looked at. And then I believe a study came out earlier this year that detected 6-PPD quinone in human spinal cord fluid.
If something gets into your cerebrospinal fluid, it means that it crossed your blood-brain barrier, a semi-permeable membrane that keeps lots of stuff that's in your blood from getting into your brain. A study out of Hong Kong published in March of 2024 not only found 6-PPDQ in humans, but in people with Parkinson's disease, those levels were double that of the general population. Whether this causes Parkinson's disease or if it's something that happens more readily in people with Parkinson's disease isn't yet known. The old chicken or the egg question. And though these folks in Hong Kong may be living in a big city, it's still really shocking to me personally that they found 6-PPD quinone so deep inside of these people.
And it really just shows us how widespread these chemicals really are. I mean, we use them in tires, but they move all around the environment, including into humans.
And likely through the air as well as through the water.
Yeah, at least some of the, you know, if you're driving down the highway at 70 miles an hour, you're blowing up all these tiny little tire particles in the air. And you're probably breathing some of those in. You know, they get inside your lungs and that moves some of these chemicals off the particle and into your blood. Or some people have detected some of these chemicals in house dust. So you're in your house and, you know, you breathe some of this dust into your body or, you know, a little gets on your food and...
Or comes in on your tire or
it,
tire,
it comes in
your
on your shoes, yeah. Might come in your shoes, other rubber things you have in your house, rubber garden hose. You know, when these chemicals are near an organism, many of them have the ability to move into that organism. And that's why we need to do a good job making sure that they're safe, non-toxic chemicals.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess the other side of that is that there's a lot of hope in that cleaning 6-PPDQ out of water sources seems to happen pretty readily through organic soils.
Yeah, so until we get the salmon-safe tires, we're going to need to manage roadway runoff. We're going to need to have treatment systems. If you have a busy road or a lot of people intersecting a sensitive habitat, especially if that's for coho salmon or other salmonids. So stormwater treatment works, roadway runoff treatment works, you know, the rain gardens, passing the stormwater through soils and things like that, you get a lot of water quality improvement. A lot of those chemicals that are present in the roadway runoff stick to the soil and then microbes break them down or just other processes kind of like remove them. The bigger problem is we just have a lot of locations where stormwater treatment's not used. So, yeah, I'm concerned about these places where we have just direct roadway runoff that goes straight to the river, straight to the creek, especially when the creek or river is small and there's not a lot of water to dilute in lower concentrations.
Yeah.
That's probably the higher risk situations.
While the ultimate environmental fate of 6-PPD quinone is still being researched, we do know that it is nonpolar or hydrophobic. So as Ed said, it sticks to organic matter in soils. So when roadway runoff is channeled through a patch of vegetation, it can do a lot to help clean it up. A 2022 report by the Washington State Department of Ecology found that bioretention was one of the best ways to clean 6-PPDQ out of roadway runoff. And bioretention is basically a highly engineered rain garden. This functions through the same principle that applies to wetlands and floodplains, areas where water has a chance to slow down and pass through leaf litter, roots, microbes, and all the things that are in healthy soil, and it gets cleaner. But what happens to the 6-PPDQ once it's in the soil? A paper published in October 2024 in the journal Environmental Pollution looked at the occurrence of 6-PPDQ in soils along urban and rural roads in a city in China. They found that fungi appeared to be more sensitive to it than bacteria did, and that 6 ppdq accumulation in soils seemed to disrupt the network structure of fungal communities. Its accumulation also seemed to slow the nitrogen and phosphorus cycling ability of the soil microbial communities. The time that it takes to break down in soil, of course, will vary depending on its composition, exposure, temperature, etc. But in a 2021 presentation on the state of the science on 6 ppdq by Dr. Jennifer McIntyre, she estimated that it's likely to persist for months in soil.
Would running through gravel do much for it, do you know?
You know, I think this type of data is still being collected. Like, we know running through sand, you know, sand doesn't do anything. Like, it might remove the rubber particle, but it doesn't remove the chemicals that are dissolved in the water. Mm. And, you know, our group and a lot of other research groups are still trying to figure out, what does gravel do? What does compost do? What does bark mulch do? You know, does biochar, you know, how much does biochar do? So all these types of different options for treatment, data is still being collected.
So as individuals, do we just drive less? Like, and then there's the aspect of electric cars producing more tire wear particles for their torque and weight. And what, you know, as a person hearing about this, what do you suggest we do on an individual level?
Well, I think on an individual level, first, just care about water quality and fish. More specifically, you know, the tire industry makes a pretty big point about keeping your tires properly inflated. Like, you know, the inflation level of your tires definitely affects how much tire wear particles they generate. So make sure your tires are pumped up to the right pressure. That really helps. They also recommend not using any of those tire care products, you know, like the products that make your tires shiny or black. That actually removes some of these protective layers that are keeping your tires durable. And so just, you know, use your tire the way it should. Yeah. And then maybe, you know, especially if you live in a, you know, right near a watershed or some creek or flowing water, don't be washing your tires and car and letting that, you know, runoff get into that creek or river. So those are maybe little actions we could do as people who have cars and drive on tires. You know, I myself, you know, have cars and tires. All of us do.
Yeah, pretty unavoidable.
Yeah.
Big thanks to Ed for taking the time to chat with me about this chemical. And thank you to the lab team at the Center for Urban Waters in Tacoma for testing all of the samples that a few dedicated NCWA volunteers and I have collected around Clatsop County at sites where bridges might be funneling contaminated water into our streams. Standing on the roadside in the rain. Love it. We started sampling in late 2022, and so far, we are seeing 6 ppdq in runoff coming off the pavement, but not detecting it in the streams. This could be due to the tricky nature of timing sampling with rain that comes after a stretch of dry weather, trying to catch a chemical cloud, so to speak, or possibly because of dilution or runoff being filtered through vegetated buffers. We are continuing to sample and to work with our partners to analyze the data and share it with the public, as well as with agencies who might help us reduce pollution in areas where we find it. Thank you to Nick Jaina for the music and to Dr. Jacob Job of the Sound and Light Ecology Team at Colorado State University for the nature sounds you hear in this episode. I'm Kelly D. of the North Coast Watershed Association. Thanks for listening to Watershed Moments and for caring about watershed health. Take care and remember, water is life. Agua es vida.